Welcome to Market Matters, our markets podcast on Making Sense, the hub for JP Morgan corporate and investment bank podcasts. In each episode of Market Matters, we discuss the latest news and trends shaping markets today.
Where your edge will always come from in equity research is the insights and the analytics that you get from that data. That is the real skill, not the data itself. If people start to see flows coming back into Europe, they will be afraid that from a fundamentals perspective, they're missing out. And I think you will very quickly see a reallocation of capital back towards European stocks. I think the key thing is going to be that data will be cross-checked with opinions much more. So data will be the truth checker versus the analyst opinions.
Hi, I'm Eloise Goulder, head of the Data Assets and Alpha Group here at JP Morgan. And today I'm really delighted to be joined by Helen Jewell, who is EMEA CIO of Fundamental Equities at BlackRock. Helen has a wealth of experience in the fundamental stock picking process, having previously worked as head of EMEA research at BlackRock and as deputy head of EMEA research at Goldman Sachs. So I'm really looking forward to delving into data in the fundamental stock picking process and how this use of data has evolved over time. So Helen, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So Helen, can you start by running through your background in your own words and also explaining your role today?
Absolutely. So I started my career back in the 90s, actually as an investment banker focusing on the utilities sector. I then transitioned to research via training. I worked in CFA training and in fundamental equity research training, really thinking about how you focus on what valuation really means. And that proved incredibly valuable as I moved into an equity research role, first on the sell side as Deputy Director of Research at Goldman Sachs. And then I moved around 10 years ago to BlackRock, starting off as the Global Director of Research at BlackRock, and then most recently into CIO for Fundamental Equities in EMEA. And it's maybe worth saying what the CIO is actually responsible for. Now, I think CIO is head of manufacturing in some ways. It's my role to make sure that the portfolios we have in fundamental equities really do what they say that they are doing, take the amount of risk that clients are anticipating, if their income or sustainable funds meet that side of the criteria as well. So CIO is a really, really interesting role in a buy-side organization.
Thank you, Helen. And such an impressive background combining research on both the sell side and the buy side at BlackRock over the last 10 years. And I'm really interested in your training related background to the extent that your focus on fundamentals and fundamental valuation is so sharp. And I'm looking forward to delving into that with you today.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. I mean, actually, the training piece is not one that I often talk about because it's a much easier story to talk about investment banking into equity research.
Yeah.
But actually, the more I am learning about the real craft of what we do, the more I realize if you do work in training, if you're able to explain to other people what it really means, that's when you really understand something. So it's something I often fall back on when I'm in my day-to-day nowadays.
Absolutely. So can we turn to data then? I mean, your career, it spanned 25 years or so now. So over that period of time, how would you say that use of data has changed in the fundamental stock picking process?
Well, if you don't mind, I might start about what is not changed, what has remained constant, because data has always been a key part of what we do in fundamental research. When you think about what data is, so I Googled this before we started, and data is facts or information, especially when examined and used to find out things or to make decisions. So facts or information, that is what data is. So what do we really do in fundamental research? Well, we build a mosaic of facts, a mosaic of information, and we use that mosaic to try and put an opinion together about what is going to happen to a company's earnings, a company's valuation. So data has always been a key part of what we do. So what has changed? I'd probably put them into three categories. Firstly, the speed at which we're able to get hold of that data. Secondly, the amount of the data that there is, and therefore the accuracy that you can get to with that data. And thirdly, where that data is coming from, who we get it from. So if we start off with the speed. I mean, when I first started my career, I used to get the annual report in hard copy. And I used to sit there and I used to input the numbers in from the annual report. When we actually started to get this in PDFs and be able to use the Control F function to find something, that felt revolutionary at the time. But now, of course, you get information pretty much in real time. So the speed is now much, much quicker. Secondly, the amount. Again, when we used to get information, you didn't really have that many sources of information. But now the amount of data is so much bigger than it used to be. And the more data and the more information you get, the more accurate you can make your conclusions going forward. And finally, it's the who. So when I first started, almost all of the information that I got came from the company. There were company filings, there were corporate meetings. But now you get so much company information indirectly from other sources, whether that's credit card information, even social media posts. What are people saying about a particular company? So it's the speed, much quicker. It's the amount, so much more. And it's where it comes from, the breadth of where that data is coming from.
Thank you so much, Helen. Well, I love that first part of your answer, that actually so much has not changed, because of course the fundamental research process has always been evidence-based, it's always been information-based, and data has to be key to that. So really helpful to hear you articulate that. But as you say, speed, amount of data, and breadth has really changed over time. So if we could look into those themes, which of these newer sources of data are proving to be very valuable, very additive to your analysts in the fundamental stock picking process, and perhaps which are less fruitful?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, the challenge of having so much data and information is to really understand which are the most relevant. I think sometimes it was a simpler time when you had less, but you just could consume all of it. Now there is so much of it. I mean, one thing that I would say is that there is a lot of information that sounds really cool and really interesting, but actually it doesn't help much. And I always use satellite information and satellite data, how many cars are going in and out of the car park. But unless you can really tie that to what is happening in the company, what is the revenue, what are the costs, then what are you actually going to be able to use that information for? So what it's about is things like credit card information, which is table stakes now, Eloise, to be honest. But credit card information has been game-changing for a lot of the work that we do. It tells you in pretty much real time how much people are spending and, most importantly, what they are spending it on. And a great example of this would be at the start of the pandemic. So if you think back to 2020, when that all first kicked off, everyone just thought nobody is going to be spending money. The world has stopped. But actually, the credit card data very, very quickly made it clear not just that people were spending money, but also that they were changing what they were spending on. Now, that information for a fundamental stock picker is just absolute gold dust. Now, then, of course, what you have to do is very quickly react to that data. Which companies are the beneficiaries? What is going to be the reflection on the earnings? Really understanding what is relevant, even if it doesn't sound as interesting, that is very, very important. Similarly with social media. Social media information is a really interesting one. Again, table stakes kind of stuff to really understand what people are saying about companies. But it's not just about what they're saying. It's about how they act on that. How does a post really then relate to whether they're spending money with that particular company? And therefore, you need the information, but you need to understand what information is very factual and which still needs that additional level of analysis to be able to interpret from.
Thank you, Helen. So social media, very powerful. Credit card data, very powerful. Table stakes, as you put it. So if it's table stakes, so it's really a necessary requirement at this stage for a fundamental analyst, does that mean the bar has just got higher because everybody has access to more granular information?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, and probably some of my colleagues will hate me for saying it, the job has got a lot harder.
Yeah.
Because now everybody has this information in real time. And therefore, it does make it much more challenging. But where your edge will always come from in equity research is the insights and the analytics that you get from that data. That is the real skill, not the data itself. Of course, there is a skill from a data scientist perspective in really being able to comb through that data. And I'm being very respectful of that incredibly important role. But for the equity research analyst, it's how do you interpret that data and what insights and analytics can you take? Because ultimately, what we're trying to predict is not what has happened, but what is going to come. And that's where the real skill comes. The original thoughts. If you think about it, and AI, it's amazing we've made it this far through the podcast in some ways without mentioning AI.
Yeah.
But AI is going to just become consensus. What is consensus? It is simply what the market is saying. What is the market? A collection of analysts, a collection of people with thoughts. So AI is basically going to become consensus. And where you make money is not by being in line with consensus. It's by having a different view to consensus. It's by understanding how quickly things like mega themes will really take off, or how slowly if you have a different view. That's where the real skill comes. And really understanding that is something which I think is going to be around as a human skill for quite some time.
Well, I love the way you're describing the edge of a discretionary stock picking investor as really combining new sources of data and presumably quite sophisticated methods of sourcing that data, whether it's social media data or credit card data, with the fundamental knowledge around the company so that those analysts can really leverage the data, question the data in the right way. And it's really interesting to hear you talk about the two together, the fundamental discretionary stock picking analyst combining that insight, that knowledge with the data.
Absolutely. I mean, imagine the power of that. I mean, that's what we try and do. You've got the quant side that really helps you drill down into what might be important. And then you overlay that with the fundamental side that really helps you understand the future. So that the quant side can really see where the opportunities might be. Where should you be paying the most attention? And that's where quant and data can really, really help. But of course, I'm biased here. As a fundamental analyst, I always think when I'm investing, I want to know what the company is, what they do, and why you think they're worth investing in and are going to generate alpha for clients.
Absolutely. So I always ask the question to our buy-side guests, what's more important, the data or the model? Now, for you, Helen, with your stock-picking discretionary lens, I'm going to shift that question a little bit. And can I ask, what's more important, the estimates, the earnings estimates, et cetera, or the valuation techniques?
Well, both are important. So I'm going to give you what I actually think is the most important, which is estimates. I think really what drives returns over the long term are company earnings. So if you get those right, then you will generate returns. But what I think is really important is, and I wish I'd known this when I was on the sell side, it's not about being absolutely correct. It's about being directionally correct. I mean, it's much, much better to be approximately right than absolutely wrong. And I think when I was on the sell side and we worked together, we had a lot of obsessions, star mine forecasts, you know, how can we be the most accurate we can be? But actually, it doesn't really matter if you say that earnings are going to go up by 8% or 9% versus consensus. If you've got a different view that you can argue and you can say, this is why I think this company is going to have better earning outcome than consensus is saying, that is valuable. So estimates, it's about the direction of travel. That's what's really, really important. So really having a clearly defined view, it's where the real value comes in from a sell side perspective. Now, when it comes to valuations, now I will start off by saying, of course, valuations start off with those earnings forecasts. A PE multiple is based on future earnings. So if the earnings number's wrong, it doesn't matter whether you think the PE is valuable or not. Garbage in, garbage out. But I think it is important that we do talk about valuation because it gives you something to anchor against. The real key is to know when and for which stocks you need to be very, very disciplined around. If you've got a stock that you are holding because you think it's a mean reversion play, a kind of value stock, you need to understand what the valuation is. Why do you hold it? You're holding it because you think it is currently undervalued. Okay, what is the point at which that thesis has played out? If, on the other hand, you're holding a stock because it's a much more high growth name, well, actually, in these cases, it can be quite dangerous to anchor against valuations. And this is really, really important. If you're investing over the long term, never forget that magic word, compounding. So important. I think once called by somebody much cleverer than me, the eighth wonder of the world. But Compounding is so, so important. And it's really important to remember how valuable that is when you're looking at stocks, particularly growth stocks. Now, flipping that around a little bit, and I don't want to end this on a down note. I am a little bit worried, having said that, Eloise, that given everything we've seen in the last 10 years, this rule of growth investing, that you don't have to worry too much about the multiple because compounding will overrule everything else. I worry that that has applied across the market and the art of valuation has been lost and that stocks have somehow become, you know, I think it's Veblen goods. The more the price goes up, the more people want them and they lose sight of that fundamental. So it's really important to recognize when valuation and multiples are important and when you can be a little bit more dismissive, for want of a better word, and not just put everything in that valuation doesn't matter camp, because that is not true either.
That is so interesting. And I think it's a fascinating time for us to be discussing this debate, you know, the multiple versus the growth, because growth as a factor has done so incredibly well over the last decade or more.
And continues to
do so well. And I guess you could argue we're in a structural revolution in terms of tech and its impact on industries. And I guess the other factor that's really benefited growth stocks is, you alluded to it earlier, but social media and the fact that there's a growing presence of a retail investor in the US and in many other markets. And I wonder if the retail investor will catch on to these growth narratives and understand and play those growth narratives, often around technology, but may not be discussing the valuations of these companies. And I wonder if that is compounding the outperformance of growth stocks.
No, completely. And you've seen that through the momentum factor. Stocks that go up continue to go up. And I do think that the increase in the retail investor, but also, let's be honest with ourselves, as institutional investors, that is something which is also very difficult to ignore. You know, I've seen many investors who've been in the market for a very long time who see these names on very high multiples, but just know that if they don't own them and they continue to go up, it hurts their performance. Mm. I had a large cap US investor who said to me, "Helen, I am being hurt in my performance more by the stocks that I do not own than the stocks that I do." Mm. And I think that shift in the market that we have seen is going to be really interesting to see how that plays out. And that's the one thing as a fundamental investor, that it is very difficult to really build into a model. You know, we all have to be conscious of where flows are going, but how you build that into a fundamental model, it doesn't come in the earnings line. It doesn't come in the discount factor. That is a real challenge. And I think that we haven't quite got that 100% right just yet. And we'll see how that plays out in the next few years, I'm sure.
Fascinating. Well, I'd love to dive into both the earnings growth, what's driving that, and also the valuation points that you've just raised. So on the earnings point, I mean, as you say, it's very difficult, particularly if we're going through a period of major technological change where growth may be superior for certain companies for a long period of time in a very material way. But how do you and your team really focus on trying to improve accuracy? As you say, you don't have to be perfect, but you need to be better than, directionally better than consensus. How do you go about that?
So I think it comes back to this point of really how we use the data. The first thing I would say is, let's not overcomplicate anything. What is an earnings number? It's the revenue less the costs. And why does revenue go up? Revenue goes up either because the total addressable market that I have is increased, or the slice of the pie that I have of that market has increased, or a little bit of both, often a little bit of both. So it's really about understanding what is going on in the market that I'm working within and why my market share might change. And guess what helps get that much more accurate? Thinking, what data may I be able to get access to that can help me address that question more accurately than my peers? So that's what we really try and focus on. We keep it pretty simple. What we are trying to do is make forecasts that are more accurate than the rest of the market. So it's the simplicity of it that I think is really important. And what we've also done at BlackRock is we've brought those data scientists into the teams. We had them as a separate team of very, very smart people building the data. And then we realize that if they're in the team, they understand what are the investment questions that the analysts are trying to solve for. And they can listen to that. And they can think, you know what, I know how to help answer that question. So if, for example, you're looking at a recruitment company and you're trying to work out, okay, is the market growing for recruitment? You've got somebody in the room who says, I know how I can get hold of this information. I can get hold of this data in an instant. And off they go and they look at job postings. So bringing those people into the team, having them around the table and really understanding what questions we're trying to answer has been an absolute game changer for how we think about data. And when we get that, you start to then really understand which of the companies have that ability to generate those earnings over a long period of time? Which are the companies that have high return on equity? And what you then see is this point of compounding again. They consistently beat. Why? Because they're in this beautiful virtuous cycle. They have higher returns. And the higher returns that you have, the more that you can invest. The more that you can invest, the more that you maybe can manage your costs, the more that you can have branding, which allows you to have things like pricing power. So they're in this lovely virtuous cycle. And that's what's often missed by analysts. And what's really interesting, Eloise, is if you miss this, you actually miss in double way, because those companies, those constant compounders, they actually get a premium to the market. So of course, they get a higher multiple anyway, because they're high returns companies. And on top of that, they get an additional premium because they can keep churning out this return time and time again. Now, on the flip side, if and when those companies miss earnings, they can be double penalized. They lose that multiple because they move down the return spectrum and they lose that premium. And that is a real juicy moment as an analyst, because either you know that they have now derated and derated for a long time, or it's a really interesting buying opportunity, because if they go up again, they're going to get a double re-rating. And so that is really, really interesting.
Thank you, Helen. And I'm so glad you brought up the return on capital, return on equity point, because of course, the power of compounding, the power of growth, you can't do that forever on one consistent capital base. You have to grow your capital base, and it's all about continuing to grow at a high return on capital. And I guess that's the only way that it can be earnings accretive in the long run.
Absolutely. And I think what's also important is how this ties back to the multiple. Because a lot of people forget what the multiple really is. What I'm very passionate about is making sure that everybody understands what fundamental multiples really mean. So if we take the fundamental PE, it's measured by looking at return on equity less growth, and then you divide that by the return on equity multiplied by the cost of equity less growth. There's my old valuation trainer coming back in the mix. But what's more important is not about knowing that formula. It's about the interaction. Why does a multiple increase? A multiple increases for one of three reasons. Either the returns on the company is increasing, the growth of the company is increasing, or the cost of equity of that company is falling. And again, it may be a combination of those three, but it's one of those three things. And people lose sight of that. They talk about, oh, the stock is re-rating. Well, why? Why is it re-rating? And if you can't answer that question, maybe it shouldn't be re-rating. And this was really interesting back in 22, when you saw that massive derating in the market. But again, think why. What caused that derating was that very, very sharp increase in interest rates. As a result, the market pulls back. Then, by thinking about where interest rates are going, what might be happening to that cost of equity, then you can decide where the opportunities come in. And I'm often asked, you know, where do you think the Fed is going? What do you think the ECB is going to do? Well, for me, that only really matters for two reasons. I'm not a fixed income investor, but it's important for me to understand, firstly, what that means to the cost of equity. And secondly, because, of course, for companies, if interest rates are higher, their costs are higher. And the dispersion between the winners and the losers is also higher as part of that. So I feel really strongly that whenever anybody is thinking about fundamental investing, and they're talking about multiples, they go back to basics. What drives a multiple? It's returns, it's growth, it's the cost of equity. Full stop.
Thank you so much for explaining that. So unbelievably critical. And to me, it's that return on capital or return on equity point that's often overlooked. You know, people talk about the potential for growth in the longer run, but don't necessarily talk about the opportunity for companies to grow at a high return on capital. If we turn to the opposite end of the spectrum, the very low growth or low return on capital type companies, how do you think about them? I mean, presumably they deserve very, very low multiples. You referred to value stocks earlier and the fact that sometimes value stocks can re-rate. How do you think about those stocks?
The key thing is the value trap, making sure that you avoid any kind of value trap. So it goes back to understanding why they are cheap and if you think anything is going to happen to change that. But actually, when you look at value stocks, look at the value stocks that have really good free cash flows. They're the value stocks that can be really interesting for investors. Firstly, because if they've got a strong free cash flow, then it enables them still to potentially grow in the future. And even if they can't, and we've seen a lot of this in the market recently, they can return that cash to shareholders. They can do share buybacks. Yeah. We've seen a huge amount of share buybacks in the recent earnings season. So for those value stocks, what we really try and focus on is the cash flows. Because if a stock, if any company is generating decent amounts of cash and has a strong free cash flow yield, it's ultimately going to put at least a floor on where the valuation gets to. So worst case scenario, you don't lose any alpha and you get some cash, you get some income. Best case scenario, the company grows and you get some alpha and some income. So they're the stocks that we really focus on.
Yeah, such a good point. And I guess if their current return on equity is lower than the required return on equity for the market, then it is rational and it's the right thing to do to return that cash to the shareholders.
You have been taught well. Absolutely. if the return on equity is greater than the cost of equity, there's always going to be opportunity there.
Absolutely. And also, I love the way you articulated the kind of, for the high return on capital, high growth stocks, this double whammy downside if they disappoint. If the duration of the growth is perceived to fall, they lose A on that and B on the multiple. And there's that double whammy. Do you ever see the opposite for low growth, low return on capital value type stocks? I.e., is there a double whammy on the upside if they can manage to surprise consensus to the upside in terms of their growth or return on capital?
Yeah, not as much. I'm going to be honest. If you're in that fourth quartile name, you kind of might be able to sneak up to Q3, quartile three. But unless you really go into that top quartile of really high return companies, you don't tend to get that premium. If anything, what you tend to see is a bit of this floor price in terms of stocks get to a certain point and they're seen as takeover targets. I would say, having said that though, Eloise, at the moment, we're seeing some valuations so low within the small cap space that it feels like we've fallen even below that for some of these value names. And I think some of that is linked so much to this dispersion between value and growth, that what was normal in terms of the value of value stocks has been rewritten. And some of the valuations of those names, they are now even lower than you would expect. Now, to me, that's a real opportunity. These are some really interesting companies, but the market needs to put the flows in the direction to really see that come to fruition. And we've not seen that coming through yet. I hope we will, but it's not happened yet.
Yeah. I mean, it goes back to a point you made earlier about how we can incorporate flows and positioning and perhaps the retail investor into the fundamental stock picking process, because so many pockets of Europe do seem to have fallen foul of this vicious cycle where they've underperformed. The liquidity has fallen. We see turnover ratios in Europe hitting all-time lows or certainly decade lows, and the momentum's in the wrong direction. And therefore, so many investor types don't want to get in. And I guess that is reflected in your valuation work where you show that they're going below prior floors.
Exactly right. And that definitely, as we talked about before, is a bit of a challenge. How do we bring that into, you know, what we do? I've talked so much recently about the valuation gap between the US and Europe. From a fundamental perspective, Europe looks so cheap relative to the US. And yet, whilst the flows keep going to the US and that virtuous cycle from a US perspective, vicious cycle from a European perspective continues, you can understand why investors are a little bit reticent. And you see that so much in your part of the world. Yeah. PB flows are so important for everything that we do. But how you incorporate it in a much more distinct way into the fundamental analysis is much more challenging.
Yeah. Obviously, there have been a number of challenges for European equities and market structure hasn't helped. In your mind, are there any catalysts we can look towards that will help reverse part of this vicious cycle?
To be honest, the only real catalyst I think there will be is if the flows start. And I do think they will happen relatively quickly because of this liquidity point. If people start to see flows coming back into Europe, they will be afraid that from a fundamentals perspective, they're missing out. And I think you will very quickly see a reallocation of capital back towards European stocks. Markets do change, markets do move. The valuation gap will get so wide that people will come back to Europe. And when it starts to move, it will happen. It happened to Japan eventually. I spent a lot of my career, as you did too, talking about Japan and then everyone ignoring it. And then guess what? Japan has been a fantastic performing market. I hope it doesn't take quite as long as that for Europe. But there is no doubt that the fundamentals will get to the point that investors will start coming back to the region. And I would say Europe is not performing as well as the US. But some companies within Europe are performing incredibly well. And what's interesting about Europe is it's across different sectors. You've got a luxury goods company, healthcare companies, semis companies. Now, across all of these different sectors, industrials companies, they're not all constrained into one sector. So you don't have the same level of contagion risk. So maybe, and of course I'm biased in saying this, you want to be selective in Europe, because if you're selective in Europe, there's some phenomenal alpha to be made.
So there's less contagion risk in your mind because there are these multiple sectors where we have strategic growth type winners. Would you say that there's also less concentration risk in European markets?
There's a little bit less, but to be honest, Eloise, there is still quite a lot of concentration risk in Europe. It's still quite concentrated into the large companies, these large growth companies we were talking about earlier on.
Yeah.
But the good thing is they are across much more different sectors. If a healthcare company goes down, a luxury goods company doesn't really get affected in the same way as you're likely to see at some point in the US.
Well, we've covered so much, Helen. I'd love to go full circle all the way back to our starting questions around data and thinking about the future. I mean, you're in the active discretionary fundamental equity space. How do you think the industry will evolve from here, particularly with respect to data?
I think the key thing is going to be that data will be cross-checked with opinions much more. So data will be the truth checker versus the analyst opinions. And I think this is where AI is going to be really useful for what we can do. So imagine this world where you've got your model and then you've got your narrative. And your narrative is what you're writing in your report, what you're saying to your clients. And then you've got something which matches the two against each other. So you've got something which says, okay, you are saying that the revenue is growing of this company, but you're having your working capital reduced. You've put the margins of this company to expand higher than the margins of this company have ever been before. And you might look at that and think, but that's right. I truly believe that the company can do this. And that's fine. But you almost have this checklist. Here are five things that your numbers are saying. Do you believe them to be the case? Do you think that this company can get a bank loan at a lower rate than it's ever been able to do historically? Do you think that it can have a higher growth rate? Do you think that the share of market is going to double in the next 10 years? And I think that having something which automatically pulls that out, a checklist. Now, we used to do that a lot manually when we were kind of involved in the sell side. I do it a lot still now. I'm never going to sit in front of somebody who covers a stock, who knows a stock intimately, and be able to know that stock better than they do. What I can do is look at their numbers and say, I know you've said this, but your numbers are telling me a slightly different story. And that's what we do as people now. We do that a lot in the CIO role, in the director of research role. And what we're going to be able to do with AI, we'll be able to utilize it as a fact checker even more. But the one thing I truly, truly believe is that we will still need humans to be able to interpret that. How does it apply to the future and how does it apply to new situations?
Well, I love this point that this perfect intersection in a way between the data and the statistics and the modeling and the humans is by using data as a truth checker. And then for the human, the discretionary lens to come in and say whether or not that is correct. And it's also making me think about behavioral biases and the fact that without that truth checker, the analyst could well, as a human, fall foul of all sorts of behavioral biases, like anchoring to consensus, let's say, or anchoring to company guidance. And actually, that data as a truth checker could really help the analysts de-anchor in some cases.
Absolutely right. I mean, that is, again, something which is very difficult to get right in fundamental analysis. How do you weave out any behavioral biases? How do you stop people falling in love with companies? You often see people's conviction get better as stock prices go up. But actually, how do you make sure everything is anchored back in data? Yeah. Back in facts and back in information.
Helen, thank you so much for coming in today and spending the time with us. It's been an absolutely fascinating, insightful conversation. I've truly enjoyed it, and I hope our listeners have as well. And you made several points, which I really want to write down and remember in future. I mean, your point with estimates, they don't need to be absolutely correct, but they need to be directionally correct versus consensus. It needs to be approximately right rather than absolutely wrong. And then the way you articulated combining the data and the systematic processes with the discretionary stock picking domain knowledge experts. And I think using data as the truth checker is so important, particularly in helping analysts to mitigate their behavioral biases.
Thank you for having me. It's been great to talk about all of these things that I feel so passionately about. So thank you for indulging me.
And thank you also to our listeners for tuning into this bi-weekly podcast series from our group. If you'd like to learn more about Helen's work and BlackRock, then please do go to the show notes. Otherwise, if you have feedback or if you'd like to get in touch, then please do go to our website at jpmorgan.com/market-data-intelligence. And with that, we'll close. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Market Matters. If you've enjoyed this conversation, we hope you'll review, rate, and subscribe to JP Morgan's Making Sense to stay on top of the latest industry news and trends. Available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and YouTube. The views expressed in this podcast may not necessarily reflect the views of JP Morgan Chase & Co. and its affiliates, together JP Morgan. They are not the product of JP Morgan's research department and do not constitute a recommendation, advice, or an offer or a solicitation to buy or sell any security or financial instrument. This podcast is intended for institutional and professional investors only and is not intended for retail investor use. It is provided for information purposes only. Referenced products and services in this podcast may not be suitable for you and may not be available in all jurisdictions. JP Morgan may make markets and trade as principal in securities and other asset classes and financial products that may have been discussed. For additional disclaimers and regulatory disclosures, please visit www.jpmorgan.com/disclosures/sales and trading disclaimer. For the avoidance of doubt, opinions expressed by any external speakers are the personal views of those speakers and do not represent the views of JP Morgan.